Church bells toll across France and around the world, marking the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I. 11 times they ring, solemnly marking the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, when the guns fell silent on the Western Front. After 4 years of fighting, 20 million soldiers and civilians had died. They were slaughtered in the trenches and fell from poison gas, or were killed in the indiscriminate bombing campaigns, or the disease and famine that walked in step with the horrors of this war. The church bells echoed with all that history this November, at remembrance ceremonies and cemeteries in every corner of the world where this war was fought. I'm Charlie Sennett, and this episode of the Ground Truth Podcast is the 11th hour. The United States came late to World War I. After 3 years of battles in Europe and the Middle East, France and England were on their heels. By Christmas 1917, the United States was officially at war with the German and Austro-Hungarian empires. By spring, half a million American soldiers were on the Western Front under General John Pershing.
3,000 miles from home, an American army is fighting for you. Everything you hold worthwhile.
Americans at home responded to General Pershing's appeal and mobilized production of munitions, food, and popular support for the war effort.
November 11th, 1918, marks the end of an era of hate and bloodshed and violence. It's the beginning of peace and goodwill on Earth. And those who have died have not died in vain. They've died to make the world safe for democracy. The war is over, and there'll never be another.
As we now know, the war to end all wars was not only a prelude to an even deadlier sequel, but also the seed for a century of upheaval. For the last 4 years, I've been working with a team of journalists to trace how World War I is the source of so many modern conflicts, many of them conflicts I've covered as a correspondent over the last 3 decades. For this report, we traveled to Europe to understand the toll the war took on the land and its people, and to Iraq, which was forged as a new country out of the war, and to Jerusalem, where you can still walk the trenches carved out by the Ottomans against advancing British forces. But we begin on the day and the place where the Great War began. Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, June 28th, 2014. I'm standing in the long shadows of a late afternoon on a bridge in Sarajevo. In a city once ravaged by war, people were now going about their day, and it was hard to even imagine the place had been under siege in the middle of the war in the Balkans. I was working on a script in my notebook. There was beautiful late afternoon light glinting off the water, and photographer Ron Aviv, a friend and colleague, was working the light. We'd chosen this day and this bridge specifically because 100 years ago to the day, a motorcade carrying Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie had taken a wrong turn. A 19-year-old Serbian nationalist pulled a pistol from his coat and fatally shot the visiting royals, the assassination that set a fuse for war.
In this city of Sarajevo, you run into history on every corner. And right here on this corner was the beginning of World War I. We've come here on the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I.
We weren't the only ones who had recognized the importance of this day. Tourists flowed into the museums and street corner where the assassination took place.
For those of you who need a city map or infos for later.
As we were packing up, we checked our phones and there were alerts on Twitter about ISIS forces mobilizing along the Syria-Iraq border. The Islamic State was recognizing this symbolic moment and rejecting the post-war rearrangement by Western diplomats Mark Sykes, and François Georges Picot. They had established French control over areas, including Syria and Lebanon, and a brand new country under British control, Iraq. They were lines on a map known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and now, as ISIS crossed the berm, they were live tweeting under the hashtag Sykes-Picot over. ISIS is a death cult, to be sure, but they do know their history. And they know how to use technology like Twitter to disseminate their ideology. The next day, June 29th, ISIS released a highly produced video in which a Chilean fighter outlines what they would call the caliphate.
As you can see, this is the so-called border of Sykes-Picot. Alhamdulillah, we don't recognize it and we will never recognize it. Inshallah, this is not the first border we will break. Inshallah, we will break all the borders also, but we start with this, inshallah.
The ISIS tweet on the anniversary of the start of World War I is just one example of how this century-old epic catastrophe still reverberates today.
Inshallah, we'll break the barrier of Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, all the countries, inshallah, until we reach Qudsi, inshallah.
Qanaqin, Iraq, September 29th, 2014. By the time we arrived in Iraq, the Islamic State's plan to erase Sykes-Picot was unfolding across the country. 100 years earlier, this area was called Mesopotamia, the cradle of civilization, sustained by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Today, it was not the Iraqi army, but Kurdish forces battling ISIS near Kubashi. From his command post in Qanaqin, in eastern Iraq, near the border with Iran, Kurdish Brigadier General Hussein Mansour made small cups of powerful Iraqi coffee on an espresso machine.
An espresso machine?
Yeah.
Espresso, but I talk to you.
The sound of distant mortar fire and field radios mixed with the ringtones of an iPhone 5. General Mansour stood in front of a laminated map tacked to the wall, and with his index finger, he circled the areas controlled by ISIS, or Daesh in Arabic. There was no trace of Iraq's straight lines anywhere on the map.
This area which he
should pointed to.
The caffeine had kicked in. Our interpreter could barely keep up with the general.
West and north,
they
But now we are sending this equipment for that corner, which is near from Saadiyya.
The equipment they were sending was sitting just outside. As we moved to the balcony, Mansour pointed at the 57 caliber anti-aircraft guns parked below.
So these are going to get used right now in Kobashi because you have Daesh in Kobashi. Like clashes happening right now.
Right now. So they are calling from the front line. They ask about okay. For them.
So is he going?
Janab Nasi Boy.
No, Amidan Eremisa.
This officer will.
Hazakay?
You like to go there?
Yeah, so we should go.
Okay, so I'm green.
I wanna.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, let's go.
The convoy drove southwest to Kubashi, where Kurdish or Peshmerga forces were waiting.
My name is Nur Abdul Majid. I'm a Peshmerga. I'm from Saadiyya village. We are here fighting. We want to protect our village from Daesh, and we want to take it over.
Why is it that the Iraqi army is not protecting you?
They don't protect us because we are the Kurdish. Kurdish. And they all protect the Arab guys. They make difference between us and the Arabs.
Is Iraq coming apart into a Kurdish area and then there's going to be a Sunni?
We don't need that. We don't need that. It's all one Iraq. We don't need to part.
As we spoke, the 57 caliber guns fired upon ISIS position.
Yeah, we need help.
No, no, it's okay.
It's outgoing.
Iwajef, another Peshmerga fighter, remains confident they will take back Saadiyya and Jalala, a neighboring village also under ISIS control. In his view, Iraq's 100-year-old borders have little bearing on who his Kurdish forces will protect.
Despite whether it's a Kurdish region or not, we have to engage with Daesh. We have to free these people inside the Anjaloula, be it Turkmen, Iraqi, Shia, or Sunni. We are fighting. We are protecting everyone here. We're not caring about the tribes or caring about religious facts. We're here to protect everyone.
As we recorded a live report, I stood in front of the anti-aircraft guns with a Peshmerga soldier training his rifle on the horizon.
This is the front line against the Islamic State. The unit behind me is a Peshmerga unit. They have just fired mortars into the Islamic State positions. They were trying to push forward here near the village of Sadia. The lines that they're fighting over here are lines that go back to World War I. All of Iraq was really defined in World War I. What we're seeing now, today, on the ground, is fighting over those same lines and a reconsidering of those lines that, as one Peshmerga commander here put it, they're lines that are going to be redrawn now in blood.
It was an image that General Mansour sketched on a map with his hand as we sipped espresso. In the months after my report, ISIS forces made gains in the region. They were ultimately driven out of this part of Iraq by Kurdish fighters. Just 3 months after tracing that line on the map, serving us coffee, and sharing his easy laugh, General Mansour was killed. He was shot by an ISIS sniper south of Kirkuk. Jerusalem, October 3rd, 2014. On a ridge overlooking the walls of the old city, just behind the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial, there are still trench lines from World War I. The British general, Edmund Allenby, was famously photographed here, looking victorious as he surveyed the Holy Land. Aaron Tirosh, the head of Jerusalem's Great War Heritage Society, led me through the trenches, now filled in with branches and brush.
So these would have been the Turkish trench lines protecting the city from British forces.
Indeed. They were built, constructed during 1917 by the Turks anticipating the British attack on Jerusalem, understanding its importance to the British and Christian world.
It's not only trench lines that mark the history of World War I across the landscape here. There are also cemeteries, neat rows of white marble gravestones that remember the fallen from the Allied forces.
On the day Jerusalem was captured by the Brits, which is the 9th of December 1917, battle continued. It wasn't ended yet. And some of the forces made their way towards North Jerusalem. They were fired upon from the ridge over here. And even this area over here was an active battlefield during the war. After that, this cemetery started its work. And actually, the Brits at the time established that nothing will be built between here and the old city itself. So we have an open view towards the old city till today.
In December 1917, Allenby's forces drove the Ottoman army out of Jerusalem. This marked the return of the Holy City to British control for the first time since the Crusades. A year after the 1919 Treaty of Versailles that ended the war, the so-called British Mandate split Palestine into what we now call Jordan and what today comprises modern-day Israel-Palestine. Jerusalem's final status has been at the core of the Oslo Peace Accord since it was first signed in 1993. That's why nearly every nation in the world, including the U.S., has kept its embassy in Tel Aviv. With the peace process faltering and the Trump administration shifting its Mideast policy to be more pro-Israel, Trump signed off on relocating the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That, in effect, granted one side, Israel, control over the most coveted part of the peace process, Jerusalem. On a recent Friday, walking along the cobblestoned Via Dolorosa, where tradition holds Jesus carried the cross, you can hear the prayers of Christians. And you can see Jews heading for prayers at the Western Wall. And Muslims with prayer rugs making their way for the noon prayer at Al-Aqsa Mosque. The ancient city is held sacred by all three Abrahamic faiths. Jerusalem, Sarajevo, and northern Iraq are just a few datelines along this present-day journey, exploring the historic shift in the balance of power after World War I. The arrogance of the international powers in redrawing the map after the war still resonates today and still shapes foreign policy across the Middle East. But on the ground, among the people in the villages, the Great War's new borders had little relevance. Neither did the four-year span assigned to this war by history books.
In the villages, in the towns, everywhere, for them, it was many little wars. They did not think of it, I am part of a great war all over the region.
Leila Fawaz teaches history at the Fletcher School of International Affairs at Tufts University. She is also the author of A Land of Aching Hearts, The Middle East and the Great War.
The Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913 had just finished. And so some people thought the First World War was a continuation. Very important, the fact that they were more concerned about their area, the women of their villages, or the men who went and never came back. So many of them never came back. The children don't remember the bad things about the war, because children find a way to have fun everywhere. But they knew that the world had changed and will never be again the same.
After the fall of the Ottoman Empire, all of the facets of identity, ethnicity, religion, allegiances, were recklessly jumbled.
You created the divisions that we have because you took a country that for five centuries had been under one Ottoman Empire. Okay, it had a lot of problems, but it was one big empire, and you subdivided it into a lot of countries through Sykes-Picot, in essence. And after that, the problems multiplied. Sykes-Picot has increased the divisions in the Middle East by clarifying the differences. It's not anymore one Ottoman Empire. It's the little divisions created from modern Syria to Lebanon to what became Jordan to what became Iraq. And you have made us dependent on areas that used to be one. So however terrible it was, it's gotten worse. People are still very different and pulled together against their will.
World War I transformed the Middle East. And we live in a moment where the Middle East feels as tumultuous as it's ever felt. What is the best way for people to understand the meaning of this 100th anniversary of the end of World War I?
That for the Middle East, we are not at the end yet. The situation is no better off than it was 100 years ago. In fact, in five centuries of Ottoman rule, it was terrible for minorities. It was terrible for those who were not part of the elite. But they were safer. And they knew their place in society. They knew I'm second-class citizen. I cannot maybe walk on the pavement. I have to wear a veil when I'm not obliged to wear. But I have peace. Peace was promised if you did certain things. Today, I'm not sure it's promised. You can do all the right things and still end up with war.
Sadly, that is the reality of the Middle East to this day. Wars in Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and the violent aftermath of the Arab Spring in Libya, Egypt, and beyond remind us of the continuum of bloodshed that is the history of the region since World War I.
It is very difficult to be optimistic looking now, 100 years later, unless the bigger picture is solved. And it's not going to come from the leadership in the Middle East or the leadership which right now is in the United States or elsewhere.
Where will it come from?
Maybe I don't expect peace to come. That's why we are in the United States. And it's not all pessimistic, but it is really a picture of caution. And I think it is possible to prevent the same thing 100 years from now. Look at the Germans. They've done it. It can be done. It can be done.
November 11th, 2018. 100 years after the truce was signed between Germany and the Allied forces, dignitaries gathered at the Arc de Triomphe. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and President Trump stood with more than 50 other heads of state. Notre Dame's bells reverberated across the wet streets of Paris. It was a somber remembrance of some 20 million lives lost in what was known as the war to end all wars, and a reflection on just how hollow that promise was. In a speech marking the century since the armistice, French President Macron warned against the demons of the past that lurk through the history of the Great War and the Second World War, which would follow. Through an interpreter, he cautioned against repeating the tragic history of both wars.
Les démons anciens resurgissent.
I know the old demons are reappearing, ready to do their work of spreading chaos and death. New ideologies are manipulating religions and advocating a contagious obscurantism. At times, history threatens to resume its tragic course and jeopardize the peace we've inherited, which we thought we had secured for good with the blood of our ancestors.
Over the course of this four-year reporting journey, I pored over historians' exhaustive research into World War I. Packed into my suitcase was a particularly heavy tome that informed my thinking of the moments leading up to the war and how to interpret them today.
1914, in a weird and paradoxical way, is kind of catching up with us. It's not just the growing distrust between alliance blocs, which people tend to focus on in the period before 1914, because they assume that for a war to come about, we should look for signs of deepening hostility between the different blocs.
Christopher Clark is a historian at University of Cambridge, England. In his book, The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914, he lays out the circumstances that led to the war, and how eerily similar they are to today.
But what's equally striking, and I think this is a more interesting and in some ways disturbing parallel to the present, is that the period before 1914 was marked by deepening distrust within alliance blocs, the breakdown of understanding between friends. The British and the Russians wound up fighting a war together in 1914, but they didn't trust each other at all. Before that year. In fact, the British in some ways distrusted the Russians almost as much as they distrusted the Germans. The French weren't sure they'd be able to count on the Russians in a couple of years' time, and the Russians weren't sure they'd be able to count on the French. Nobody felt they could count on the Italians, not even the Austrians and the Germans, their official allies. So it was a world in which the distrust seeped into the relationships between friends, and that created as much risk, as much uncertainty, as the hostility between alliance blocs.
In his speech, Macron also championed the continued alliance between European powers.
L'amitié forgée entre l'Allemagne et la France.
On our continent, such is the friendship forged between Germany and France, and the desire to build a foundation of shared ambitions.
L'Union européenne.
Such is the European Union, a freely agreed union never seen in history, delivering us from our civil wars. Such is the United Nations organization, the guarantor of a spirit of cooperation to defend common goods in a world whose destiny is inextricably linked and which has learned the lessons of the painful failures of both the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles.
But the rising tide of nationalism in the form of Brexit and election gains among extreme right political parties in Poland, Hungary, Italy, and beyond threatened to undermine the European Union's relevance. The election of Donald Trump and his America First foreign policy have also challenged the international order and threatened alliances forged out of the world wars. On the recent trip to commemorate the centenary, President Trump stood with world leaders and fellow members of NATO. That alliance had been a steadfast bulwark against Soviet aggression during the Cold War. But since his inauguration, President Trump has been dismissive of NATO.
We're looking at very difficult days, in particular for the most important alliance in the world, NATO, which has played a key role in keeping the peace since the Second World War, and whose future at the moment is in doubt. I mean, it's no longer clear how strong and how lasting the American commitment to NATO is. And there are also signs of growing distrust and uncoordination within the European NATO partner states and within the EU. So there's a sort of general decline in cohesion, not just an increase in hostility, but also a decline in cohesion and predictability, which is, I think, worrying, and which not only itself constitutes a risk, but encourages those who make decisions which might, touch on war and peace, more inclined to take risks because it makes them more nervous.
1 week before the 2016 presidential election, Christopher Clark and his colleague Andrew Preston wrote an article comparing then-Republican nominee Donald Trump to Wilhelm II, Germany's last emperor.
The Kaiser was, many historians agree on this, had an almost pathological inability to express or possibly even to feel empathy with other human beings. He could be extremely brash and boastful, but he was also very thin-skinned and prone to anxiety. And he was unpredictable. People compared him to a cushion and said he's like a pillow in the sense that he carries the imprint of the last person who sat on him. So he was sort of impressionable, but also impulsive, a weird combination. Someone who could be, it was easily manipulated by momentary emotional states, but on the other hand, was prone to impulsive outbursts of rage and irritation, and which he found very difficult to master. So, I mean, the comparisons just go on and on. The one that really has started to intrigue me since Trump came to office is that before he came to office, the Kaiser was involved in setting up a kind of hotline with Russia. He'd managed to sort of wangle himself into a special diplomatic mission to Russia. And while he was there, he told everybody, not to trust his father, the Crown Prince, who was regarded as a Russophobe. And he said, no, talk to me instead. I can tell you guys what's going on in Berlin. I'll tell you what's happening in my father's court. He's going to be the next Kaiser, so this could be really useful intelligence for you. And he indeed did start this secret exchange of letters with the Russians, providing them with very high-quality information about what was going on in Berlin. This eventually stopped, of course, but it's interesting to see that, that both of these office holders, as it were, have sort of been overshadowed to some extent by the question of their relationship with Russia.
At this point, President Trump himself denies business dealings with Russia, either before or during his election. But new reports reveal secret deals between Trump and President Putin. These reports have enraged the president, most notably in his tweets. It's sobering to realize how an individual leader's temperament can wreak havoc across the globe. I asked Christopher Clark about the lasting legacy of World War I.
This is a period when violence is unleashed on an unforeseen scale. And, of course, the culmination of all that is yet another war, this time a truly exterminatory war launched by Nazi Germany. So it's very hard to kind of, to use that sort of trendy expression. It's very difficult to get closure on the First World War. There isn't any obvious end. And that's I think, the most horrible thing about it. And it's worth remembering that it wasn't really an ending. It brought peace to people living in rural England and Paris and French towns and so on. But in Eastern and Central Europe, it was just the beginning of a whole cycle of new nightmares. I think the other thing, if we ask ourselves, what should we remember? War is always worse than you think. And it's a beast that no one controls. The extraordinary thing about 1914 to 18 is how much worse this war was than the worst scenarios that anybody had imagined before 1914. So, in other words, it's a reminder, I suppose, just to fear war much more than we do. We don't fear war enough, and we don't love peace enough. We so easily get bored with peace. And I think that's a terrible, terrible mistake. And we should remember that, war is not a way of clarifying issues. It does exactly the opposite, and its costs always far outweigh the benefits.
It's difficult to imagine the scale of death and destruction that World War I left across Europe. Though today's tools of war are more advanced and lethal, the number of casualties of the 20th century's first total war, one that makes no distinction between combatants and civilians, is staggering. The horror and disbelief also yielded some of the most memorable anti-war poetry and music in history. Brian O'Donovan is a friend and colleague and the host of WGBH's A Celtic Sojourn. Brian, you've really helped me understand the meaning of the tragedy of this war through the spoken word and through music. And help us try to get inside of that. Why is poetry and why is music so important in understanding the war?
Well, this war was particularly disruptive in the social fabric of Britain and Ireland, in my experience. And it's really that body of poetry and songs that were written contemporaneously and subsequently that has fascinated me in this war to begin with. I'm sure there are similar bodies of work in other combatants around Europe and indeed beyond. But it's hard to imagine the scale of the change that went on. You know, we think of it in terms of statistics, people dead. But we can't possibly imagine what it was like to lose an entire village of men, multiple villages in a region in England, for example, on a single day, because they often had those men fighting in the same battalions that would be wiped out in some of those mega battles that we've become familiar, like in Ypres and the Somme, for example, or in Gallipoli or along the deadly Dardanelles. So just the impact, the emotional impact, the human loss, the emotional loss of partners, of families, as I said, of entire communities, is hard to really understand except through poetry and music and the works of art that came from that devastating period. Take this song, for example. The band played Waltzing Matilda by the Scottish-born Eric Bogle, one of the great anti-war songs written in the 1970s.
Then a big Turkish shell knocked me arse overhead, and when I woke up in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, well, I wished I was dead. Never knew there was worse things than dying, for I'll go no more waltzing Matilda. All around the green bush far and free, to hum tent and pegs, a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me.
So I'm familiar with Waltzing Matilda from Tom Waits' interpretation, and I think all of us have heard the song at some point in folk music. But what's the song's meaning in relationship to World War I?
Well, Waltzing Matilda is really an anthem of Australia and being Australian. It's one of the songs that anybody leaving Australia would carry with them. It's played at public events there. It's played at weddings. It's known to every single young and old Australian alike. It's something that brings somebody together. So in the 1970s, Scottish-born Eric Bogle used that national motif, if you will, as the backdrop to one of the more powerful anti-war songs ever to be written. It's called The Band Played Waltzing Matilda. And what it really covers is the Australians, huge numbers of Australians and New Zealanders who were recruited for that famous and doomed assault on the Dardanelles near Gallipoli in Turkey. And they would have been, as Australians abroad, singing Waltzing Matilda, the classic version. They would have been singing that as they were in camps and at battle and everything else. And that's what Eric Bogle really uses as the backdrop to this powerful song.
Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, oh, come a waltzing Matilda with me. And their ghosts may be heard as they march by that billabong. Come a waltzing Matilda with me.
So as we've said, it's not only this powerful and beautiful music, but it's also the poetry of World War I that really echoes through history. And I think there's one poem in particular that is a favorite of mine. It's William Butler Yeats' The Second Coming. And I think the words of that poem really bring home this idea that the meaning of World War I is still resonating with us today.
Well, I think it's so ominous, Charlie, that you pointed out that The Second Coming was written in 1920, really. So it has such an ominous feel to it. And that wasn't lost on Yeats. he knew that coming out of World War One, the world had changed and was very conscious of the world changing in the subsequent 2 years after Versailles, after the peace, after the dividing up of the Middle East, for example. There was an unease in Europe. And indeed, that unease was reflected in Ireland at the same time. So he was taking his whole approach to mysticism and putting it right in these verses, which sound vaguely biblical. And that was very deliberate on the part of Yeats. He wanted it to be a little bit obscure, a little bit religious, a little bit mystical. And there's an ominous atmosphere about this poem that has a great sense of unease after you finish reading it.
It does feel foreboding and, God forbid, prescient. It was certainly prescient in its own time in talking about the coming of World War II. But the thing that I think is so powerful about that poem today is that it really brings home this idea that once again it feels ominous, that the history of World War I, as we've seen on this long reporting journey, really resonates today. So it's almost the perfect way to end a long reporting journey. Would you read that for us?
The Second Coming, William Butler Yeats. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming? Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born.
Brian O'Donovan, reading The Second Coming.
Now when I was a young man, I carried me pack.
If you enjoyed this episode, let us know what you think and give us a rating. Tell your friends they can subscribe to the Ground Truth Podcast on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever they listen. If you ever miss an episode, you can find the entire archive at our website, thegroundtruthproject.org.
My country said, son, it's time you stop rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun. And they marched me away to the war.
This piece was produced by Mitch Hanley. Thanks to Nina Porzucchi, Phil Rado, Bob Kempf, John Ryan, Travis Stewart, and Doug Sugertz at WGBH. Funding for this episode comes from WGBH News and the MacArthur Foundation. I'm Charles Sennett, executive producer of the podcast and founder of the Ground Truth Project, which supports a new generation of journalists to do on-the-ground reporting. Next time on Ground Truth. Christian Zionism has gone from the fringe to the mainstream.
We're from Alabama in the United States, and we are here for the feast!
Awesome. And why is it important to be here?
Because we love Israel.
And the blessing of the nations come from Israel.
That's right. From evangelical Christians, we see about $250 to $300 million come in a year.
Christian Zionism, the fulfillment of prophecy in American foreign policy. The end of days on the next Ground Truth. Thanks for listening.